And now for the main message today, I'd like to introduce the pastor of the Bath, Ohio congregation, Bill Watson.
You know, this week while I was sitting in the motel room, I happened to see an interview that was being conducted with Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise was being interviewed by, I think it was Larry King, if I'm not mistaken, if I remember correctly. And he was going through some things regarding his life and so on, but was also, interestingly enough, touching on his faith. And that's the operative today that I want to talk about a little bit. As a matter of fact, the title of my presentation today is Faith. What is it? You see, Tom Cruise's faith is rather unique in that he is a member of the Church of Scientology. Now, I don't know how many of you are aware of what the Church of Scientology is all about. I think, as a matter of fact, John Travolta also is a member of that particular faith. The Church of Scientology. And it is a very affluent organization, as you can imagine, even by just the name of those two individuals who donate quite a bit of money to that organization. You can imagine, because there are additional movie stars and what you could say elitist types that are part and parcel to this. As a matter of fact, the Church of Scientology is a rather fast-growing organization, faith organization. And it was an interesting discussion because it presented the Church of Scientology in a very contemporary fashion and in a very contemporary mode. And it deals with, frankly, a lot of good things in respect to how to improve yourself. Nothing wrong with that. And it was geared, in many respects, the conversation and the interview toward trying to elicit commentary from Tom Cruise about just what it does for him. And what it does for others and all of their charitable works and so on. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, it's not my place to judge this particular faith. I'm not here to do that in any way, shape, or form anyway. But I couldn't help as I was listening. And I really wanted to just kind of listen to what he was saying. But I couldn't help but to notice just how humanistic it was. Very, very humanistic. And what I mean by that is that, and again, I don't pretend to be a, what you could say, knowledgeable person on Scientology. I speak from only that soundbite that I heard from the interview. So don't get me wrong. I don't mean in any way to indicate that this is the final statement on the Church of Scientology. It isn't. But I couldn't help but to conclude in my own mind, based on what I heard, that it was rather godless. Now, that may sound somewhat of an oxymoron because, well, Bill, I thought he was talking about a faith. Well, yeah, he was. But see, it was all about him or you or about what you can do for yourself to improve you, to be better for others. Nothing wrong with that in its premise. But it is quite, you could say, conflicting with Christianity. Because, you see, Christianity isn't all about you, is it? See, that's the unique thing about Christianity. Christianity, it's all about God. It's all about you glorifying God in you. And you do that by coming to a better understanding of what God is. And we understand, in short, of course, the personage of Jesus Christ is that example that we should aspire to in hopes to mimic, to copy, to be a facsimile of, and in so doing understand by virtue of the words here of God that we are pleasing God. But see, what I got from Tom Cruise was that that's not as important as it is pleasing myself so that I might be able to please others, you see. That's what I mean about it. When I say godless, that's what I mean by it being godless because there was very, very little mention. Matter of fact, there was no mention of God. It was just a lot of mention about him. Faith. Faith is an interesting word, isn't it? And it is a, what you could say, rather curious word because it is dealing with the unknown. Because if you have faith, you have faith in something you don't know yet. You haven't obtained it yet. Otherwise, you wouldn't have faith. You'd have it. You don't need faith because I've got it, you know. I have faith that my Bible's at home. Well, as long as I'm not at home, I have faith that my Bible's at home. But once I get home and I see that my Bible is there, my faith is over. I mean, I don't need faith anymore. I've got my Bible, right? I'm at home. There it is. I see it. You with me? The Bible has three words primarily about faith, and I want to talk a little bit about faith. I don't know if I'm going to finish today. Probably won't. But I want to take you through some segments of the Bible that illustrate the kind of faith that I'm talking about, and certainly the kind of faith that Jesus Christ wants you to have. The first word in your New Testament, like I said, there's three primary words in the New Testament that are used, translated into faith, and one is pistis. And what it simply means is persuasion, credence, means there's credibility. Conviction, it can mean truth, reliance, assurance, belief, simple belief. I believe, you know, I believe. Fidelity, pistis. Second word is oligopistos, oligopistos. Oligopistos is the opposite of pistis. Oligopistos means lacking confidence, incredulous, little faith, you don't want oligopistos, you don't want that, you want pistis. That's what you want to aspire to. The third word is ellipse. And ellipse basically means expectation, confidence, or hope. It's found only in one place in the New Testament. It's only used once, Hebrews 10, verse 23. It's just used once, ellipse. The whole New Testament. The other two words are primarily the ones that are used in most cases. But the point that I want to make in this is regardless of what word is used, what you find is faith is a state of mind. It's a mental disposition in your approach towards something, whatever it is. You have faith in this contractor, he'll do a good job. It's a state of mind. Now, why you are of that state of mind regarding that particular issue is another story. All I'm telling you is faith is a state of mind. It's a mental disposition. I have faith that this investment is a good investment. And therefore, action generally follows your faith, does it not? You, if in this case, it be an investment, the action that would follow is you're going to come forth with a few dollars and invest in whatever that investment is. Faith is a state of mind. It's a mental disposition. I want to explore some things here in Luke, in your New Testament. I want to go to Luke first, Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7, here's a story, and we're going to explore a few stories here, that illustrate some circumstances that involve faith. They involve faith. And I think there's some things here that we can learn in these circumstances, but by the same token, I want to caution us on coming to any conclusions today. I want to lay down some information. I want to lay down a lot of information. I want to lay down some things for you to consider. I want you to think about some of these things that we're going to read here in your Bible about these stories dealing with today exclusively Jesus Christ and his ministry and some of the things he found himself involved with pertaining to faith. We're going to stay exclusively in the Gospels. Luke 7 and in verse 1. We see here now, when he had ended all of his sayings in the audience of the people, he entered into Capernaum, and a certain centurion's servant, that is, who was dear unto the centurion, was sick. And he was ready to die. So here you have a centurion who has a servant who's deathly sick. And this servant was dear unto this guy. He really cared for him. So here we find, when he heard of Jesus, when the centurion heard of Jesus, he sent unto him elders of the Jews. Now, chances are, in most cases, we're going to see here in a moment, this centurion is not a Jew. He's not an Israelite. He's probably a Roman in most cases. He's in charge of some Roman legions. And consequently, in this particular case, is, for all intents and purposes, not, as I say, considered part of the Jewish lineage. And so he asks the elders of the Jews, he probably went down to the synagogue, beseeching him, that is the Jews, that he would come and heal his servant. So this centurion goes ahead, he gets these Jews, and he proceeds to get these Jews to appeal to Christ to attend to his ailing servant. Verse 4, "And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this. For he loves our nation, and he has built us a synagogue." Did you notice that? The Jewish elders are talking to Jesus, and they're telling him, "Jesus, this is a good guy. He's done a lot of good things for us." Now, Jesus is a Jew, right? Keep that in mind. Jesus is Jewish. The Jewish elders are asked by the centurion, "Go tell your Jewish master, my servant is sick. Please tell him to come to me and heal my servant." The Jewish elders go to Christ, who's Jewish, and they say, "Jesus." Verse 4. "When they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying," and I'll say this again, "that he was worthy for whom he should do this. For he loves our nation. He's built us a church building." He's a good guy, even though he's Roman. You know, he's a good guy. Verse 6. "Then Jesus went with him. And when he was now not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying unto him, Lord, trouble not yourself." So here's Jesus. He's walking now to the house where the centurion is. All of a sudden, some people come up to meet him, you know, before he gets to the house, and they say, "Whoa, hold it, Jesus, wait a minute." They stop him. And they say to him, "That trouble yourself not, for I am not worthy that you should even enter my home. Don't even come in my house. I'm not worthy of it. I'm an unrighteous man. You're righteous. Look, this is what I want you to do. Wherefore, neither thought I even myself worthy." That's why I sent my servants out, because I'm a no good you know what. I didn't want to see you face to face, Jesus, because I'm embarrassed. So I sent my servants, my friends out to you to tell you this. And what they told him was, "Look, stop. Don't come into my house, because our master's not even worthy for you to enter in. Wherefore, neither trouble I myself worthy to come unto you," verse 7, but this is what I want you to do, "but say in a word, and my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man set under authority." He's a centurion. That means he was a captain of at least 100. So he's used to being in authority. He's used to saying, "Attention, move to the left." And people move to the left, you know. "Move to the right." They move to the right because he's a commander. So he's thinking in these terms. He's in a state of mind. He has a mental disposition about his approach in this. So he says, "For I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers. And I say unto one, go, he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it." Verse 9. When Jesus heard these things, he was surprised. He couldn't believe it. He was taken back. He was, "Whoa, this is amazing here. This is just," it marveled Jesus. And it even turned him about, and he says unto the people that followed him, "I say unto you that I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And they that were sent, returning to the house, found the servant whole that had been sick." Interesting story. What's it tell us? Well, you think about it for a minute. Take your time and think about it. But in the meantime, let me go on. Verse 11. Came to pass. Here's another story. The day after, he went into the city called Nain, Many of his disciples went with him, and many people. When he came near to the gate of the city, behold, there was a dead man carried out. Now here is the man, notice. He's the only son of his mother, and she's a widow, no father. I'm the only son. I don't have any brothers or sisters. So this would be like I was dead, and my dad had died, and my mother was my only parent left. And now she lost me. You with me? So now it's only my mom who's a widow. So this is a woman who had one son, no husband, and her son's dead. And many people of the city was with her. Verse 13 now. Now remember, Jesus is just walking to Nain, to the city. He doesn't know who's in that coffin. He doesn't even know this woman. He's just walking to Nain. The Lord saw her, and he was moved with compassion. Now, you need to know what that word compassion is. I'm not telling you. You need to look it up. Take some time this week. Look it up. What motivated Jesus? Your Bible says in the English translation here, my King James, compassion. Compassion motivated Christ. This woman didn't do a thing, brethren. She was just weeping. She was a widow. It was her only son. Jesus is just nonchalantly going to the city of Nain, and lo and behold, comes up on this funeral. That's what we've got here. And all of a sudden, he, Christ, is moved with compassion. And look what he does. He says to her, stop crying. Don't weep. He stops her and says, don't weep. And he comes and he touches the coffin. That's what that word is, the coffin. He puts his hand, didn't even open it, didn't even look at the body. He just touches the coffin. Picture this in your mind. I'm trying to take this slow so you don't only just read through this. I want you to put an image to all of this. Think back. You know what the Middle East looks like. Think of the dirty roads. You know, they weren't paved. They were dirt roads. Here comes Jesus walking up with his buddies to the city of Nain. Picture this in your mind. Comes up. Don't cry, lady. Don't cry. Touches the coffin. And those who bore the coffin stood still. And he said, Christ did, young man, didn't even know the kid's name. Didn't even know his name. Young man, I say unto you, arise. Get up. And he that was dead sat up, began to speak, and he delivered him to his mother. And, verse 16, notice the reaction. There came great fear on everybody that was there that witnessed this. They glorified God, saying, a great prophet has risen among us, and that God has visited his people. Verse 17, now notice this, continued results of this event, continuing results of this event. Rumor of him went forth throughout all of Judea, throughout all the regions round about. So this event generated the results of what you could say additional public relations, exposure, an audience and advertisement of Christ's power. You with me? And hence served to augment, accentuate, and substantiate his reputation. His reputation. Keep those things in mind. Now let's go on over here to Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5 for a moment. Mark chapter 5. Do you hear a little feedback? Is it the mic? This mic? Okay. Thought I was just hearing ringing in my ears. Okay, Mark 5. Now, this is the story. I'm not going to deal with a lot of details concerning this story in the beginning verses here, other than to mention here the situation to bring your attention to where we are. And essentially, where we are is where it dealt with a fellow that was possessed with a bunch of demons. Matter of fact, the demons were named Legion. Remember this story? Legion means many, you know. And hence, we read here the situation where Jesus comes up in the Gadarenes here, leaves a boat, comes across to the other side of the from the Sea of Galilee to a country called the Gadarenes. And he comes up on this fellow that for years has been known to be demon-possessed. Verse 8, for he said unto him, come out of him, you unclean spirit. And he asked him, what is his name? Jesus did to the demon, demons in this guy. And the demon said, my name is Legion, for we are many. And he besought him much that he would not send them away out of the country. The demons were communicating with Christ. Now there were near under the mountains a great herd of pigs. So there were a bunch of pigs that were, for all intents and purposes, feeding in the area. And all the devils besought him, that is, besought Christ, saying, send us into the pigs that we may enter into them. And forthwith Jesus gave them leave. In other words, he allowed for it. He allowed the demons to leave the man who had been for all these years demon-possessed, this legion of demons, and they went into the pigs. Another good reason not to eat pigs. I'm just kidding. But at any rate, the point that I want to make here is in verse 14, and they that fed the pigs fled and told it in the city and in the country. So the news again spreads. Jesus Christ took demons out of that guy that we all know has been demon-possessed for years and put all the demons in the pigs. And I know I own the pigs. I've been taking care of the pigs, and I watched them all leave him and go, and they went over the cliff. And all this news is going all over the city and all over the area here. And they that fed the, verse 15, and they came to Jesus to see him that was possessed of the devil and who had the legions sitting and clothed. You have to remember this guy used to run around naked all the time. He was just really a kind of a, you know, a lunatic of the neighborhood, as they would say. So here now all the people come up and they find that he's sitting there clothed in his right mind. And they were all afraid because they knew this was strange. I mean, they all knew this guy was a lunatic. Now all of a sudden they come up on him and lo and behold, there he is clothed, for one, sitting around a fire, for two, and he's in his right mind. He's rational. And they that saw it told, look at this now, more news, told them how it befell to him that was possessed with the devil and also concerning the pigs. So they more people were telling the story, and they began to pray to Jesus to get out of the out of there. They didn't like Jesus being there. They didn't, hey, this is too strange. We want you to get out of our area. You're a strange guy, Jesus. You know, you that have power like this. We don't really want you too close to us. Now, verse 18, when he came into a ship, he had been, when he that was, let's see here, verse 18, and when he was come into the ship, he that had been possessed with the devil prayed him that he might be with him. But Jesus permitted him not. He didn't want this fellow who was formerly demon-possessed to be a disciple at this time with him in the way he wanted to be. In other words, he wanted to be part of the gang. He wanted to be part of the troop that was going around the country. Jesus said, no, I don't want you to do that. Instead, look what Jesus says. He says, go home to your friends. Tell them all the great things that the Lord has done for you. And I like that because, you see, Jesus identified himself, didn't he? Jesus identified himself one-on-one to this guy. He said, tell them the Lord, he's talking about himself, the Lord, that's with a capital L, has done for you and has compassion, there's that word again, on you. Need to look up that word. Need to look up that word, compassion. Compassion on you. And, now, verse 20, he departed and went on to Decapolis. And how great things Jesus, that is, had done for him, and all men were surprised. They all marveled. Now, in this particular case, we continue on here, where Jesus, as we saw there, got a lot of notoriety as a result of that event. But we continue on because there's going to be more things happening here as we proceed through this chapter. Verse 21, Jesus now was passed over again by ship unto the other side. Much people gathered unto him. He was near unto the sea. And behold, there came a ruler of the synagogue. Now, this is a Jew. Okay, he's a ruler of the synagogue. So he must be a priest, rabbi. He's something. His name is Jairus. His name is Jairus. And when he sees him, he, the ruler, this priest, this rabbi, falls at Christ's feet. So Christ takes these demons out of this guy that was a lunatic on the other side, gets all that done, all the news travels all abroad that Jesus is really a scary guy by the locals because nobody's got this kind of power. They've never seen anything like this in all their lives because this guy was a lunatic for many, many years, and they told Jesus basically to leave. The lunatic, who was formerly a lunatic, wants to be a part of the troop, the original troop. Jesus says, no, I want you to go back home, tell your family and your friends what wonderful things the Lord has done for you. In the meantime, Jesus gets back on the boat, goes across the lake, on the other side, and proceeds to disembark and begin to walk. And lo and behold, this guy Jairus, a Jew, a rabbi, some priest of the synagogue, the local synagogue, comes up and slams on the ground at his feet. This is all happening. This is all happening. And Jesus, and verse 23, and he besought him greatly, saying, my little daughter lies at the point of death. I pray you, I supplicate, I appeal to you, come and lay your hands on her, that she may be healed and that she may live. I mean, he's passionate. He's intense. He's moved. His daughter, his little daughter. And you're going to find out this little daughter was 12 years old here in a minute. And she was deathly sick. And he comes and he flings himself at Jesus' feet. Now think about what caused him to do that. State of mind. It's a mental disposition. The man had a state of mind, didn't he? For a ruler of the synagogue, a man of integrity, you know, a staid teacher, one who's got a lot of educated letters behind his name, throws himself and grovels at the feet of some 30-plus-year-old young man, 30-some years old. Who knows how old Jairus was? Jairus could have been easily in his 50s or 60s, perhaps with a 12-year-old daughter, maybe 40s or so. But here, a leader of the neighborhood, picture these things in your mind, brethren. Just don't read over these things. Literally falls in the dirt on Jesus' feet. I mean, he's got a reputation. He's got a reputation to protect here, or to at least, you know, maintain. And yet he didn't care, did he? He didn't care how humiliating it looked, how embarrassing it may have been for his reputation. All he knew was he had a sick daughter, and he had a mental state of mind, a mental disposition that said, no matter what, Katie, bar the door, by hook or by crook, I'm going to try to get Jesus Christ to my home. You with me? And so he comes here, lays at his feet. He says, I encourage you to come to my house. Jesus obviously was moved by this. Verse 24, much people followed him, and the throng with him, and a certain woman. So Jesus, he is moved. He basically goes with him. While he's walking with him, and a great throng of people are with him, a certain woman who has a blood disease sees him. This is all happening. Another frame of mind. Here's this woman who has an issue with blood. She's got a disease. Could have been leukemia. We don't know what it was, but it was some kind of blood disease. She sees Jesus walking with this great throng of people, a tremendous multitude of people. That's what we have here. And we read here a little bit about this woman. We get a little thumbnail sketch of her. It says here, this woman had an issue of blood for 12 years. So she has been sick now for 12 years. She's also suffered many things from many doctors, many physicians. Okay? She's spent all that she's had. She's broke. She spent all of her money. And was nothing better for it. Matter of fact, it says here, she grew worse. She was worse. So, you see, we have a little bit of a thumbnail sketch here of the woman. We have a thumbnail sketch of the woman. And we go on here in verse 27. When she had heard of Jesus, she came into the press behind him and touched his garment. For she said, now we understand this is apparently what she had voluntarily mentioned to Jesus later on, because here Mark writes it down. He must have been there and heard her explain herself, because you're going to see here she did explain herself here in a moment. But she said in her mind, apparently at this point, if I may touch but his clothes, I will be healed. It's a pretty firm state of mind. It's pretty affirmative. Pretty assured. Pretty confident. And all these people are around him. Can you imagine trying to touch the president's tie in a public affair? Or could you imagine trying to get up on some celebrity who's doing some kind of a thing, and you're going to break through the crowd to get to that person to just touch their arm? Well, that's what this was kind of like, because Jesus, remember, over here in verse 24, there was much people followed him and thronged him. Okay, so we move on here. Straight away, the fountain of her blood was dried up. She touched him. She did get to him. She felt her body that she was healed of the plague. Jesus immediately knew in himself that this virtue, that something had happened, had gone out of him. He turned around and he said, "Who touched me?" Well, the disciples who were around him said, "Wait a minute, don't you see the multitude around you? What do you mean, who touched you? There's all kinds of people around here. Everybody's touching you, you know." That's basically what they're saying here. And he looked round about to see her that had done this thing. And the woman, fearing, trembling, verse 33, knowing what was done in her, came and fell before him and told him all the truth. And he said unto her, "Daughter, your faith." That's what I wanted to point out to you here now. Why don't you take note of that? "Your faith has made you whole. Go in peace and be whole of your plague." Now, verse 35. I want you to think about that. Just want you to think about that. "Your faith, daughter, has made you whole." Verse 35. While he yet spoke, there came the ruler of the synagogue's house with certain news, "Your daughter is dead." Because remember, Jesus is on his way. Remember, he's on his way to Jairus' house to heal his daughter. And this woman with the blood happened to interrupt him. Well, now he continues on, and he's interrupted in the trip, and lo and behold, the news is, "Your daughter is dead, Jairus." Verse 36. As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said unto the ruler of the synagogue, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid." I want you to take note of that. "Only pistio." I will tell you this. Only, this is not pistis. This is not the other one. This is pistio. Pistio. It means to entrust or to have faith. So, don't be afraid. Don't be fear-struck. Instead, aspire to entrustment. That's what he's saying. Aspire to confident belief. That's what he's saying. That's what he told the guy. Don't be afraid. Let that go. Aspire to belief. And he permitted no man to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Verse 38. He comes to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, Jairus' house. He sees the tumult, all the confusion and so forth. Them that are weeping and wailing greatly, because there was a cultural thing there where they had actual professional weepers, because they were all, the daughter had died, So this is what Jesus is walking into. He's walking into a Jewish home that is mourning the death of this little girl. And so he walks into this, verse 39 now. "When he was come in, he says unto them, Why make you this ado and weep? The damsel is not dead, she's sleeping." She's dead. Jesus, though, remember in John 11, he doesn't characterize death as death. He characterizes it as sleep. Always has. You know why? Because in the realm of God, death is nothing more than a temporary sleep between lives, because we're all waiting for a resurrection. And God calls it like it is. As far as he's concerned, the person is not dead. What real death is in the realm of God, brethren, is the second death, that of a willing heart rejecting God and then you being extinguished by God. The deaths of your moms, your dads, your children, currently, now, are nothing more than reprieves of life characterized by Christ as sleep. It's real simple. We haven't lost anybody yet. No one's lost yet. Not one person. They're just all sleeping. And it's a matter of timing of when they'll be brought back to life via a resurrection. That's what your Bible teaches. So now here, Christ says, she's sleeping. They laugh. What? She's sleeping. She's dead. They think Christ is making fun. Think about this. This is the circumstances he finds himself in. They laughed him to scorn. But when he had put them all out, he told them all, get out of the room. He takes the father, the mother of the damsel, and them that were with him, and enters in where she, her body, was lying. So only the mother, the father, and Peter, and John, and James, and Jesus are in the room. Jesus tells everybody, get out, 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 everybody out. Shut the door. And now they're all in the room. And there's the little girl. And he took the damsel by the hand. He walks up to the body. And he says, I say unto you, arise. And straight away, she arose and walked. She was 12 years old. They were astonished with great astonishment. And in this case, he charged them straightly that no man should know it, and commanded that something should be given to her to eat. She was hungry. She probably woke up and said, I'm hungry, you know. 12 years old, I don't know how long she's been out, but she was hungry. The obvious issue would have been that, you know, when they opened that door and she was alive, everybody was probably talking about it. What do you mean she's alive? How can, you know, and regardless of the fact that Jesus didn't want it to be known, it got known all over the place, needless to say. In that regard. Now, going on to Mark chapter 10 for a moment. I want to introduce you to these stories, brother, and I want you to take note of how these things and these little things that I'm giving you, these little vignettes of how not to have fear, but to aspire toward belief. The other case, it was your faith, the woman with the blood. All these things I want you to take note of, because all of these are part and parcel to the ingredients of where I'm taking you through as we attempt to try and identify and define more clearly what faith is all about. Chapter 10, book of Mark. Chapter 10, book of Mark, and in verse 46. They're on the road again to Jericho in this case. And he went out of Jericho with his disciples and a great number of people. Blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging. So here you have this blind beggar at the highway, and he's begging, and he hears that Jesus of Nazareth is coming. He begins to cry out. And he says, Jesus, you son of David, have mercy on me. He's crying. He's screaming at the top of his lungs because he knows Jesus is coming down the road. Many charged him and they said, shh, quiet, shh, you're making a scene. Shut up. Be quiet. Keep your peace. But he cried all the more great. Son of David, have mercy on me. So the more they told him to be quiet, the more they told him to tone down, the louder he got, the more outrageous and outspoken he became. And he says here, Jesus stood still and commanded him to be called. And they called the blind man. They said unto him, hey, be of good comfort, rise. He calls you. And he casts away his garment, rose, and he comes to Jesus. And Jesus says unto him, now notice, blind guy, he's been blind for a long time. Blind for a long time. He's been screaming and yelling. Everybody's been telling him to shut up. He wouldn't shut up. Jesus finally says, bring him to me. People say, hey, be of good cheer. He wants you. Throws off his coat. State of mind. Mental disposition. He's got one thing on his mind. And Jesus is going to ask him what it is. Look at this. Jesus says unto him, verse 51, what do you want that I should do to you? So there's Jesus and the blind guy. The blind guy can't see him. All he hears is Jesus' voice. And Jesus says, what do you want from me? What can I do for you? Blind guy, there's no question about what he wants. He's got a state of mind. He's got a mental disposition. He's got one objective in mind. He wants his eyesight. And he believes, is it fair to say? Because by virtue of his activity, his actions, his, you know, engaged behavior, proves that he knows and believes that Jesus has the power. The blind guy says unto him, Lord, that I may receive my sight. Jesus says unto him, go your way, your faith has made you whole or healed you. And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus in the way. So, summary for a minute. Let's just stop for a minute because we've read a lot of things here. Sometimes we see that Christ himself was moved by virtue of his own heart. Fair to say? We saw some stories of that. The woman, remember, the widow, lost her only child. She didn't do anything. She was just having a funeral. Her son died. Or her child died. Jesus came up on the funeral, laid his hand on the coffin. Bible says he was moved by compassion. She didn't do anything. She didn't even ask for him. She didn't even scream out and say, oh, Jesus, could you heal my son? He died. Or my child, he died. Didn't do that. Jesus was moved. So we see, in some cases, Jesus himself was moved. Sometimes, secondly, it appears that it was perhaps good PR. It got his name out there, didn't it? A lot of people started talking about him. That there was purpose behind it. Because remember, brethren, there was a mission that Jesus Christ was on. So there's a lot of things in the background, a lot of things that are in the mix that cause things to happen for purposes that sometimes are not all that necessarily focused on the recipient as much as it is the focus on the outflow or the outgoing or the spin-off results of the event. And thirdly, we see also that some people had to have belief, confidence, and assurance that he could indeed do some of the things that he said he could do. And consequently, he told them, it was by your faith, your belief, your pistis, that has afforded you this benefit of what you've requested from me. Now in Luke 8, let me change my direction here just a little bit. Luke 8. And in verse 22. Now it came to pass on a certain day that he went into the ship again with his disciples, and he said unto them, let's go over unto the other side of the lake. And they launched forth. As they sailed, he fell asleep. Jesus fell asleep. And there came a great storm of wind on the lake. They were filled with water, and they were in jeopardy. The boat was tossing and turning and so forth. And they came to him and awoke him, saying, Master, Master, we perish. And then he arose, rebuked the wind, the raging of the water. They ceased, and there was a calm. So they were all excited. They were all upset. You know, you can picture this. Jesus was sound asleep. This storm comes in. The boat starts rocking and reeling and so forth. And they don't know what's going to happen to them. They go to Jesus. Jesus, Jesus, wake up, wake up. We're in jeopardy. We're in danger. You know, there's a great storm. We're being tossed to and fro here. Jesus then gets up, rebukes the wind and all the raging water, and everything ceases. And there was a calm. And he says unto them, where's your faith? Where's your pistis? And they, notice this, being afraid. They were afraid. You see, perhaps there's a relationship here with fear. Perhaps. We're going to talk a little bit more about this as we go in the future, but I want to bring your attention to these operatives. They being afraid. That's a reason for that being stated here, brethren. They were afraid, and yet they were lacking faith at the same time. Is there some relationship here? Some correlation? And they wondered, saying one to another, and they were talking amongst each other now, what manner of man is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him? So they were talking among themselves, and you can see the doubt in their own minds that they still weren't convinced at this time in the ministry that Jesus was the guy. And Jesus rebuked them for the lack of their faith. Up here to chapter 17, book of Luke. Chapter 17, book of Luke. He says to his disciples, it is impossible, but that offenses will come. But woe unto him through whom they come. It were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and he cast into the sea that he should offend one of these little ones. Take heed to yourselves. If your brother trespasses against you, rebuke him. And if he repents, forgive him. And if he trespasses against you seven times in a day, and seven times in a day turn again to you saying, I'm sorry, you shall forgive him. And we've always made a little joke about the fact of the next statement because, you know, for you to forgive and forgive and forgive and continue to forgive somebody who continues to mistreat you, the only comment that you, in most cases, humanly speaking, can say is the next statement here in verse 5. And we often kiddingly use this statement to say, the apostle said to him, Lord, increase our faith, you know, because it takes a lot of faith to continue to forgive somebody who continues to mistreat you, and rightly so. But that's not really the right interpretation. And actually, the subject changes a little bit here in verse 5, and a new set of circumstances is established, and the apostles then now engage and initiate new dialogue by stating this. And the apostles said unto him, Lord, increase our faith. Now, here comes the lesson on how to do that. Here it comes. He says, the Lord does, if you have the faith as a grain of a mustard seed, and that's a real small little seed, brethren, you might say unto this sycamore tree, be thou plucked up by the root, and be you planted in the sea, and it should obey you. Now that kind of sounds a bit unrealistic. It's a little bit over the top. For you to say, you know, microphone, move from here to the door. And if I have the faith of a mustard seed, you know, I ought to be able to do that. Which means that because I can't do that, I don't have any faith. Is that what the point of this whole story is? No. It's a figure of speech, brethren, to make a point. What's the point? Verse 7. But which of you, having a servant, now he's going to give us a little relationship here. Which of you having a servant, now remember, if you have a servant, you're the master, okay? You're the master. We're talking in terms of ownership and slavery, so to speak here. So the point here is that which of you have a servant plowing or feeding cattle and will say unto him, your servant, by and by, when he has come from the field, go and sit down and eat. Will not you rather, being the master, say this, make ready wherewith I may eat, and gird yourself and serve me till I have eaten and drunken, and then afterwards you shall eat and drink. And Jesus is putting in a question. Well, right. I mean, that was the culture of the time. I mean, if I own the land and I hire servants to work, believe you me, I'm the boss. I'm going to eat first. They're going to eat after I eat. That's what Jesus is saying here. Isn't that what normally happens? Yes, that's what normally happens. Okay. Verse 9, does he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? Jesus says, I trow not, I suppose not. That's what Jesus says. No, why should I? If I hire you, like in Dave's case, to lay some floor, and he lays the floor, and I pay him, what's he done? Well, he's done what's expected of him, and I paid him for it. We're even. Done deal. I don't owe Dave anything, and he doesn't owe me anything. I mean, I could say thank you, but I really don't need to. I paid him. It's a done deal. It's over, you see, because he did what was expected of him. Does he thank that servant because he does that which is commanded of him? No, I suppose not, Jesus says. So likewise, you, when you shall have done all the things which are commanded you, say, you're unprofitable. Oh, I've gone to church. Every Sabbath I go to church. I pay my tithes. I study my Bible. I don't swear. I don't get drunk. You know, I don't commit adultery. I don't lie. I don't do any of these things. Well, what Jesus is saying here is, that's expected. That's nothing. That's all part of this calling. You haven't done anything extra as far as Christ is concerned. He says here, we say to yourself, so likewise, verse 10, when you shall have done all those things which are commanded you, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do. What's the point? Step out on faith, and do more. Step out of the box. push yourself to become something you're not. And be of good cheer and be of confidence and be assured, because you're in the best hands you could ever be in, that God will have his way with you for your betterment and for your improvement. Don't be fearful. Believe. Aspire to pistis. You see, that's what Christ is saying in this story. And he says, you are basically the mountain. To change human nature, to change a drunk from not being a drunk anymore, is a miracle, brethren. To change a prostitute from being a prostitute, a druggie from being a druggie, a porn star from being a porn star, a thief, a liar from lying, is a miracle. To change somebody's behaviors and break their cycles and change their habits is like moving mountains once humans get ingrained in a path. It is difficult to change at best. Can it be done? Sure, it can be done. But it is usually done through what? In Tom Cruise's case, what I learned is through faith in what Scientology can logically give me to mechanically develop a frame of mind that can put me in a mental disposition to overcome things that cause me pain. In so doing, hopefully, I can serve others to be better as well. Nothing wrong with that, except you left God out of it. Major point. I would say a major point. You left God out of it. Because when it's all said and done, without God, what you've got is just this. This life. It's all there is without God. With God, you not only have this life, but you have the world tomorrow, the kingdom of God, eternal life in a whole different life form, a species we know as spirit beings. That ultimately will be awarded to those who learn to develop what we're talking about. And what we're talking about is this faith that we're trying to define. Over here in Matthew, let's go to Matthew 17 as we begin to wrap this up. Matthew 17, real quick here, verse 14. Matthew 17, verse 14. And we read here, when they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man kneeling down to him, saying, Lord, have mercy on my son. He's a lunatic. He's sore vexed. Oftentimes he falls into the fire, and he's often in water. I've brought him to your disciples. Now look at this. I've brought him to your disciples. I hadn't had a chance to get him to you, but I have brought my lunatic son to your disciples. They couldn't cure him. Jesus answered and he said, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him here to me. Jesus rebuked the devil and he departed out of him. The child was cured from that very hour. The disciples came to him apart and said, why couldn't we cast him out? What happened? Why were we unable to get rid of this demon? And Jesus says unto him, because of your unbelief. For truly I say unto you, if you have faith the grain of a mustard seed, here he goes again with that small little seed, you shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Howbeit, this kind goes not out but by prayer and fasting. Oh, so now we've got another element here. Another element. In other words, could we ever find ourselves in a situation where God wants to learn a little bit about us? How bad do you really want it? How bad do you really need what you are asking for? And what's the next element of expectation here? What prevented these guys from not being able to get rid of this lunatic, this demon out of this lunatic son? Jesus implies, look guys, it's your unbelief. Understand something. You need to add some additional activity to build on your faith. What's that? Fasting and prayer. I just want you to take note of this. for consideration. Mark 11. Let's wrap this up. Mark 11. Jesus, again, is on the road. He comes up on a fig tree. On the morrow, verse 12, chapter 11, book of Mark, he says here, when they were come up from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree afar off having leaves, he came, if haply he might find anything thereon. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves. For the time of figs was not yet. And Jesus answered and said unto it, meaning the fig tree. He's talking to the fig tree, and he says, no man eat fruit of this hereafter forever. And his disciples heard it. So he curses the fig tree. Now, let's put this in perspective. He's hungry. He's coming into Bethany. He sees a fig tree far off with leaves on it. We're told it's not the season for figs. Now, do you think Jesus knew that it wasn't the season for figs? Of course he did. He didn't need to get up on the fig tree to find out there were no figs on the fig tree. He knew there were no figs on that fig tree, even from the first time he saw those leaves. Because he knew, he was brought up in that area. He knew that that was not the season. And we're told it wasn't the season. So it was no surprise, is my point, for him to come up on the fig tree and say, ah, cursed be that fig tree, you know. No one shall ever eat from it. So what's the point? Is he just using his power flippantly? Is he just a cavalier about things? No, there's a point. Jesus always had a point, brethren. There was always a lesson to be... That's why it would have been so interesting to just kind of walk along with this guy. Because everything he did had a point. Look at this. Drop down to verse 20. In the morning... Now they're leaving. They went on down to the house of God, and actually in between, it's even quite comical because Jesus was on his way into Jerusalem and ended up in the temple, remember? And he made a whip and he whipped all the money changers. He got a little macho and told them all, get out. You know, can you imagine this? I mean, picture this in your mind. He's on his way into Jerusalem. In the meantime, he goes into the temple where, I mean, it's very formal. It's very staid. It's very culturally managed. And he goes in there, makes a whip, kicks tables over, whacks the Pharisees, whacks the scribes and the money changers, screaming at the top of his lungs, get out of my father's... I mean, he was, you know, really passionate and animated about all this stuff. Gets all done with that, and then he leaves. Verse 20, in the morning, he passes by. They saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. Peter's looking at it, and he remembered and said unto him, Master, behold, the fig tree which you cursed, it's withered away. And Jesus said unto him, and here's the whole point. He's going to use it as a lesson. He did this. He set a stage, brethren. Why? Here's the lesson. Have faith in God, not in yourself. Tom Cruise, John Travolta, Scientologists, if that be at the underbelly of the Church of Scientology, and I say if, because again, I don't know. I only heard a little snippet of an interview from one member. I may be way out in left field. And if I am, I stand corrected. But if I'm correct, if I am correct, I say, have faith in God, not in the ability to mechanically understand your own human nature and by virtue of being able to manage through temperance and so forth in the psychobabble and psychoanalysis of thyself, control your appetites and so forth to provide you to be a better person or a more manipulative person, whichever may suit your case, human nature being what it is, and the heart being deceitful above all things, and we know that, then what Jesus says here to Peter is very appropriate. Forget it, you see. Forget all that. Because that's a dead end. It doesn't lead anywhere. What's important here is have faith in God. Verse 23 now. For truly I say unto you, that whosoever shall say unto this mountain, here he goes again, be you removed and be you cast into the sea, and shall not doubt in his heart, but shall believe that those things which he says shall come to pass, he shall have whatsoever he says. Therefore, I say unto you, what things soever you desire, when you pray, believe that you receive them, and you shall have them. And when you stand praying, forgive, if you have aught against any, that your Father also, which is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses. But if you do not forgive, neither will your Father, which is in heaven, forgive you your trespasses. So we've entered in a new thing here, brethren. Forgiveness is part of the equation. We know fear has a negative reaction to faith. Forgiveness, if we're unforgiving, has a negative impact to faith. And we're also told here, and I know perhaps as I was reading it, maybe even some of you were thinking, well, does that mean if I want a 20,000 square foot home, all I've got to do is pray to God? Hey, God, I want this 20,000 square foot home over on the cliff on Route 1 in Malibu, you know, where I can just kind of relax and retire as I drive from my place to the store in my Maserati, you know. Is that, and I can ask for that and expect it? Is that what we just read? Because, I mean, at face value, I mean, if you take it for what it just said, you could kind of construe it that way, couldn't you? In Hebrews chapter 11, I told you I'm not going to answer a lot. I'm just going to ask questions here today. Hebrews chapter 11. I'm going to give you an assignment. I'd like you to take some time and just think about this scripture. Get a few translations. Get a concordance. Kind of sit down and think about what this says. Get it squared in your mind. Verse 1, chapter 11, book of Hebrews. Biblical definition of faith. A biblical definition of faith. Because what we've been talking about, brethren, is defined right here by your Bible. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Huh? And get your mind around that. And then in a couple of weeks, we'll resume.